Welcome to the Back 9 Report, presented by eDraft.com.
Hello and welcome to this week's edition of the Back 9 Report, presented to you by eDraft.com. We go live every Tuesday at 8 p.m. Eastern Time and check in on the world of golf to bring you the latest news, insights, analysis, interviews. Hey, we cover anything and everything golf. My name is Carlos Torres. Every week, I'm alongside my co-host, Fred Altvader. Fred, hi, how are you today?
Carlos, the temperatures will reach into the 60s this week in Northwest Ohio, and I finally got my first glimpse of grass in over 6 weeks. Spring may well be on its way here. Let's only hope. Hey, Dustin Johnson got his first win since returning from his leave of absence. Indy Park finally beat Lydia Ko. And Donald Trump did not like J.B. Holmes shooting a 62 on his $250 million Doral golf course. A lot to talk about tonight, Carlos. Let's go.
There's a lot to talk about, but before we go to the United Golf Network presenting the Par 5 news presented by United Golf Network, I just have to say something, Fred. I have to. I mean, I predicted it. The winner last week of the WGC category. I said it was going to be Dustin Johnson. I got
it. You were keeping track, but...
No, why would I? Why would I? But since we're talking about it, I believe you're going to award Rory McIlroy with something. I don't know what's more awards to Roddy, to Rory. What's all this about?
You know, sure, Dustin Johnson won the big check at the WGC Cadillac Championship, but Rory McIlroy gets honorable mention for the world's best club toss. The world number one proved he is also quite adept at the fine art of club throwing. It has been kind of a rough start for Rory in the U.S. After playing so well in the Middle East and at the end of last year, you know, the frustration must have been building after that missed cut last week at the Honda, and his first round one over par 73 left him far behind the leader after the first day. Rory's 73 on Thursday came in nearly perfect conditions with little or no wind, and the PGA Tour had set up the course as easy as it could play. J.B. Holmes found it to his liking, posting a 10-under 62 in the first round. And I know you're going to have more to say about that. It was so easy it had Dirt Donald hopping mad. Nobody should shoot those kind of numbers on one of his creations, especially when he sinks $250 million into it. Even so, there's a lot of water on the Blue Monster, and 106 golf balls found watery graves just in the first two rounds alone. The frustration for Rory became so great that after pulling his 3-iron second shot on the par 5 eighth hole into the water on Friday, he executed a perfectly thrown club into the water hazard. He had struck a beautiful 302-yard drive, put himself into position to reach the green, and then came the errant shot. You know, I know exactly how he feels. I gave my 3-iron a permanent timeout years ago. He did exhibit excellent form on the toss, great turn, full extension, and follow-through was perfectly executed. Not to worry, no animals or fish were injured in Rory's fit of emotion, and the disobedient 3-iron, thoroughly rinsed, has been recovered. Donald Trump hired a scuba diver to retrieve the petulant 3-iron the next day. Ron Green Jr., by the way, has a well-written piece in Monday's Global Post about the lack of protocol on the golf course by young Rory. But, you know, maybe Rory was just tired. Even though he didn't play the weekend at the Honda, he partnered with John Pinkham to win the pro member gross division at iconic Seminole on Monday and Tuesday. He began his day with three consecutive birdies and went out in 6 under 30, ultimately shooting a 63 on his own ball. And there is no rest in sight for poor Rory. He has to fly to Augusta to walk the hallowed fairways with Super Bowl champ Tom Brady. You know, Carlos, being number one in the world does seem to have its advantages.
It does, but you know what I'm going to suggest to you? You know, you can get that video from Rory while he's tossing it and use it to perfectly portray how you can explain, you know, the perfect turn, the swing, and all that. Make it in your classes, you know. If you get mad, this is how you toss your club.
I think you know, when I was younger, it was definitely one of my stronger aspects of my game. I have a quick story to tell you, Carlos. The last time I threw a club, I was playing in a tournament, and I had a really nice round going. I was only like one over through 14 holes. And the 15th hole was a very easy par 5. I played the course many times. I knew it. I just butchered the hole, ended up walking away with a double bogey 7. And as I walked off the back of the green, I gave my putter a toss, and it flew up in the air, just hit the branch of a tree, correct, just enough. It snapped that putter right in half. I had to finish the round putting with my sand wedge. I tried my 3-wood. Needless to say, it was not pretty the last few holes. So I never threw a club after that.
last time I threw one, you know, it fell right between some people that were behind some trees, and I started looking like who threw that? You know, I just kept walking. You know,
who did
man,
that?
Who is that? Oh, man, so insensitive.
That guy's real idiot.
Since we're talking about the WGC Cadillac, you know, let's go back in time to last Thursday at around 10:06 a.m. Eastern Time. You know, back there on the 10th hole of the Toronto Royal. You know, Jimmy Holmes at that time was taking the tee and started off his round with 2 straight birdies and an eagle on 12. You know, Elder Donald surely wasn't happy to see anybody off to a 4-under after 3 holes. And most certainly his unflappable hair must have been donkey-like after 15 holes later when he watched how Holmes went on to birdie 16 and 17 to shoot, you know, 6-under 30 for his first 9 holes of that day. He didn't let up on the back nine either. He birdied 4 more holes on his way to a bogey-free 10-under 62, leaving that field in the dust and terrorizing totally that blue monster. He came out and did the unthinkable. You know, no one, like you mentioned, no one was supposed to shoot 10 under at Trump National Thursday. And not with the wind up that featured 15 to 20 miles per hour winds, and with only 21 players that shot under par on the Blue Monster flashing its teeth. But Holmes took it to another level. He, you know, that's why he was asked what course was he playing, or like Luke Donald tweeted later on, which planet he was playing on. He made it look easy, but it wasn't for the majority of field, which averaged 73.4. Something like that 73.4 would have pleased Dirk Donald, but Holmes happened. How dare J.B. Holmes did to treat the infamous blowhard Donald Trump's precious suburban Miami golf course like a red-headed stepchild. I mean, nobody thought a score of 62 was possible on the Gil Hans redesigned Blue Monster, especially the man who bought the course and ordered a makeover. According to multiple reports by the Golf Channel, Mr. Trump was furious with damn near anyone associated with the PGA Tour after his course was brought to its knees by the long-hitting Holmes. At least my man Sergio was as accurate as I was with my prediction. You know, he tweeted afterwards that he didn't see that happening at Trump Doral this week, but he still believed that single digits under par would have won that week, though. See, you know, great minds think alike, like Kieran said last week. But, you know, Trump didn't even congratulate Holmes on his record-setting feat. Mr. Trump must have been fuming. I have never seen a conniption, Fred, but I can bet that his face must have transfigured with his head splitting and fire coming out of his eye sockets of his skull.
Fred, did his hair get messed up, though? That's what I want to know.
No, his hair was okay. It was the right.
Oh, is it perfect?
But,
okay.
Yeah, the hair was perfect. But I don't know what the fuss was for him. You know, he should know that shooting 62 wasn't the only incredible thing that Holmes did that week. He beat Dolphins quarterback Ryan Tannehill in a football throwing contest, so he was hot. You know, at least the consolation prize for him was that JB didn't win. But like I said, Dustin Johnson won.
Well, you know, I don't know why, you know, we're going to talk about it later, but why is Donald so adamant that the golf course has to be so hard? I don't get it, but more par time. Hey, Carla, something else that happened at the WGC Cadillac this week, something new. Adam Scott, who was next to last in putting on the PGA Tour in 2009 and 2010, you know, while on break in Australia in the winter of 2010, picked up a long putter, anchored it under his chin, and put it into competitive action at the 2011 WGC Match Play Championship. He went on to win the WGC Bridgestone later that summer, had the near miss with the runner-up finish at the 2012 Open Championship, won the 2013 Masters. He added wins at the 2013 Barclays and the 2014 Crowne Plaza just for good measure. Threw in three wins on the Australasia Tour in 2012 and 2013. Oh, yeah, and he had that nice runner-up to Rory McIlroy at Royal Melbourne in 2013. So needless to say, the long putter was very, very good to Adam Scott. But he showed up with the short putter in Miami this week. With the impending rules change by the USGA and the RNA, which will render the long putter with the anchored stroke illegal effective January 1, 2016, Scott decided it was time to return to the regulation putter this week at Doral. He posted rounds of 70, 68, 75, 71 for a total of 4 under par, good for tied for fourth on the difficult Trump Doral. His 4 under par 68 on Friday was the low round of the day. It should be noted that his length off the tee may have been more a factor than his newly renovated on the newly renovated Doral, as the winner, Dustin Johnson, runner-up J.B. Holmes, and third-place finisher Bubba Watson also finished 1, 2, 3 in driving distance for the week. Doral has become a big hitter's ballpark with the secondary priority of keeping the ball out of the water around the greens. Scott finished the week 12th in strokes gained putting and had 114 total putts for an average of 1.58 putts per green, which is very good. Anything under 1.7 for the pros, they will take it. That's pretty good stuff. Now, it should be mentioned, though, that reading and putting the greens is not nearly as challenging at Doral as those elephant mounds at Augusta National. But finishing that high on the leaderboard in his first tournament using the regulation putter is very encouraging for the former world number one. His new putter was not the only thing new for Adam Scott at Doral. He has a new baby at home and a new caddy, veteran Mike Kerr. Said Scott, "Everything was getting a little boring, so I decided to completely change everything." Of his putting performance for the week, "I think I putted very well overall and feel very comfortable with where I am. I've got to test it the next couple of weeks again, and hopefully it keeps improving, and I'll be a red-hot putter by the Masters." Even by his standards, his last couple of weeks have used... Oh, I'm sorry. He said, "I think we've had a pretty good run of things over the last couple of weeks." So things are really on a high for Adam Scott. Good for him, and he seems to be playing well, Carlos. I think you've got some more news about the... women admission to St. George's.
Oh, I do, and things are getting very good moving forward with the women. And, you know, a premier UK golf club will admit female members for the first time in its history after a landmark vote, leaving just two male-only clubs on the Open Championship rota. The Royal St. George, the British club in Sandwich, Kent, that once posted the sign, "No dogs, no women," has finally voted to admit female members with immediate effect after 90% of ballot members voted in favor of female membership. The club follows the example of the Royal and Ancient Golf Club of St. Andrews, which in September ended a 250-year rule against women members. Earlier this year, Prince Anne and Annika Sorensen became two of its first female golfers. The St. Andrews Golf Club is now in merger discussions as well with the Ladies Golf Union, also based at St. Andrews, which started the Women's British Open in 1976. In January, Mirfield said it would review its membership policy, spurred by the St. Andrews vote. Royal St. George had been in consultations about female membership for more than a year now. So the vote leaves only two open clubs presently not admitting female members, both in Scotland, Mirfield and East Lothian, home of the Honourable Company of Edinburgh Golfers, and Royal Troon in South Ayrshire. Troon, as you all know, is hosting the 2016 Open Championship and is reviewing its membership policy before that start date. So that's very good news. Hopefully those two, Troon and Mirfield, will get some very good news this year for the women and start accepting them. But there's also some more great news for the women's golf, and it's because England, Wales, and Scotland have all expressed interest in hosting the Solheim Cup in 2019. That's what the Ladies European Tour has announced. The three home nations are among 10 countries, record-setting interest there, who could be in the running to host the biennial event, with Denmark, Holland, Norway, Portugal, Spain, Sweden, and Turkey having also expressed an interest. The decision on which country will host the event is expected before the end of the year. England has never before hosted the contest, while Scotland played host in 1992 and 2000, with Wales hosting it in 1996. Europe will be looking for a third consecutive win in the competition when it's played in Germany in September, while Iowa will be playing host in 2017. So, Fred, these are two very big news for women's golf. Royal St. George is one of Southern England's most recognized golf clubs, and opening up to women is a big, big step forward. And for the Ladies European Tour, it's great news about the interest in the Solheim Cup, which adds much-needed income to that tour. That, if you compare it to the impact that on the European Tour has had the Ryder Cup, so it helps keep the solvent for it.
Yeah, you know, Carlos, we've documented it that, you know, women is the largest or fastest growing segment in golf currently. So it's great to see women gaining positions, being allowed to join, become members of these men-only golf clubs. And I just think it's a great deal for golf in general, and I applaud them. And, you know, the Solheim Cup gaining so much attention and raising the interest level in Europe is really a big deal for the Ladies European Tour. They need that money. I mean, they really need it. And it'll be like the European Tour that gets healthy every 4 years when the Ryder Cup comes over. The European Tour, you know, that makes them, that covers their shortfall the rest of the time. So this is going to be a big deal for the Ladies European Tour. And getting that interest level up of that Solheim Cup, you know, it helps you in the U.S., but it really helps a lot in Europe. Carlos, in our last item here, our little tap-in to finish off our Par 5 news tonight, the PGA Tour caddies that filed the $50 million lawsuit against the PGA Tour, in the spirit of Valentine's Day in February, sent a little love note to the tour last week. If you remember, Carlos, the tour did not provide adequate shelter for the caddies at the Honda Classic 2 weeks ago when a violent storm ripped through the Palm Beach area on Friday. Well, the Caddy Association took exception to yet another slight by the PGA Tour and sent Commissioner Tim Fincham a note. The Association of Professional Tour Caddies formally requests that the tour require each host organization to provide safe, commodious, clean, and convenient accommodations for all caddies, and immediately repeal any and all rules and regulations that prohibit caddies from entering the clubhouse. Read the letter signed by their attorney, Christian Denny. According to a tour spokesman, caddy hospitality is provided by the individual tournaments, and Honda Classic tournament director Ken Kennerly said last week that his team is reviewing its evacuation plan and wasn't made aware of the unsafe conditions for the caddies till after the fact. Well, yeah, he probably wasn't aware because he was warm and dry in the nice, comfortable clubhouse. We evacuated players and caddies and got them off the course, and thousands of spectators were removed safely, Kennerly said. We will have a more comprehensive evacuation plan next year involving the caddies, and this has never been an issue. We will make sure we review it. That sounds an awful lot like a plan to catch the horse after it's already out of the barn. Some tournaments, like the Crown Plaza Invitational and the Tour Championship, have moved caddy hospitality into clubhouses. but tour-issued caddy credentials do not include access to clubhouses during tournaments, and according to the circuit's regulations, quote, caddy shall not enter the clubhouse unless properly credentialed, except when they are immediate family and accompanied by a player. Caddies, for reasons that escape logic and fairness, are either provided no shelter or pushed to temporary shelters with apparently little thought given to their safety, the letter said. Relations between the tour and the caddies have cooled since a group of more than 80 caddies filed a class action lawsuit last month. Carlos, in yet another questionable move, the tour recently canceled the annual caddy dinner and quarterly meeting that was scheduled for next week at the Valspar. The caddy's attorney said, it's my understanding there were some communications that said the tour is not going to have any formalized meetings with the caddies while there is a lawsuit. You know, it just amazes me. I think the PGA Tour may want to reexamine their current attorneys they have hired. Whoever is advising them on this course that they are currently taking, is it's going to cost the tour a lot more than $50 million. This all looks really, really stupid to me, Carlos, and a no-brainer for any judge and jury. The PGA Tour better get its head surgically removed from its posterior before the caddies end up owning the whole kit and caboodle. Hey, Carlos, that ends the Par 5 News presented by United Golf Network. And United Golf Network wants every golfer to enjoy the game more and have the opportunity to earn some money while doing it. They offer top line of golf products, including popular name brands like Nike, Wilson, Greg Norman, Ashworth, TaylorMade, Adidas, and Where to Win. Everything a golfer needs, clubs, balls, bags, shoes, apparel, and accessories are available through United Golf Network with discount coupons for huge savings. United Golf Network not only has an excellent product line, it also offers every golf nut the chance to earn commissions on product through their director's program. United Golf Network provides instant and free access to Global Affinity, which offers discounted travel through Wyndham Endless Vacations. Another free perk is membership to MyGolf in U.S., which offers discounted golf rounds in 16 states and 3 Canadian provinces. And finally, For Sale by Owner allows you to sell used or new equipment and earn sales credits. So visit UnitedGolfNetwork.com today. Check out the products, discounts, and their opportunity, Carlos.
Yes, they are created by entrepreneurs to give golfers the opportunity to play golf, make money, and enjoy life. United Golf Network. So that wraps up the Par 5 News presented by United Golf Network. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we have not one. We have two VIGs, very important guests of the week. Don't go away.
Thank you for listening. We'll be right back. In the meantime, don't forget to visit www.edraft.com for analysis, breaking news, and more. Also, remember to follow us on Twitter at edraftsports and on Facebook at facebook.com/edraftsports. Now, back to the show.
And we're back, and now it's time for our VIG segment of very important guests of the week. We don't have only one. We have two guests. One of them, the first one that we're going to bring to you, is Jim Starr. He's the president of Absolute Golf, Michigan's largest golf ball company, which is looking to retrieve 4 million balls this year and has many stores across Michigan selling their products. They have also partnered with Growth and Opportunity, which is handicapped special needs employer in Lapeer, Michigan, to assist in their packaging needs. They just opened a new store in Utica, Michigan, and they are proud to have the largest golf ball selection in the Great Lakes state. So, Fred, how about this interview with Jim Starr?
Yeah, you know, I had the chance to meet him at the Toledo Golf Show. And I just found his story amazing. He started diving for golf balls from ponds on golf courses near where he lived in Michigan when he was in high school. And he turned his part-time summer job into a full-blown career. But that was after he spent 12 years split between the Army and the Air Force, plus another 6 years in Iraq working as a fireman with EMT. He now lives between homes in Michigan and the Philippines. He's just a remarkable young man, and I found him a joy to talk to. I wanted to get his story down. I didn't get it done here at Toledo, and so my wife and I went to the Michigan Golf Show last week, and he was there, and so we sat down and talked a little bit and just taped a real short interview, but really, really a cool guy.
Let's hear it.
We are here today at the Michigan Golf Show in Novi, Michigan, and we're talking to Jim Starr from Absolute Golf Ball. And Jim has a kind of a unique business model where he grabs up used golf balls and refurbishes and brings them to the market so that all you golfaholics out there can buy them up and lose them again. Is that about right?
Yes, sir.
Jim, how did you get started in this business?
I used to retrieve golf balls when I was 15. A gentleman came into the dive shop where I filled my scuba tanks, and he asked me if I'd be interested in diving in a pond.
So from that, as I understand, you kind of turned that into your summer business, and you were making as much in a summer as your dad was making as an engineering job.
Yeah, my dad was shocked because I was pulling in 3-4 months what he made in a year, and just diving for golf balls.
So as you got out of high school, you decided to join the military. So you spent some time out of the country. You were in the Army for a while. You ended up in the Air Force. You ended up in the Philippines. But you ended up going back to Iraq even after you were out of the military.
Yes. A friend offered me a job out there, and I missed the excitement.
You spent several years as a fireman and EMS tech. Is that correct?
Yes, sir. Yeah, I was. I ran the training for Kuwait and Iraq.
That is phenomenal. I've never met too many people that have done that. My hat's off to you for doing that. So anyhow, when you decided to get out of that, you had some injuries from work, and so you decided to get out of that. You were laying on the beach in the Philippines, just kind of kicking back. You decided you wanted to do something, and you got back in the golf ball business.
Yes, I still had courses calling me after 20 years, and I decided to come back and give it a try, and we turned it into a nice little family business.
You actually have a machine, a winch, that goes across the pond and drags it, so you don't actually have to go in the water yourself anymore.
We use Kubota tractors, and we have them engineered to pull 1,000 feet of cable across the pond and pick up all the golf balls that the golfers lose.
When you go to a golf course, you know, a public golf course, maybe getting 25,000-30,000 rounds a year in, how many golf balls can you pull off of that golf course?
It depends on the water hazards, but we pull out anywhere from 10,000 to the most we've ever pulled out was 250,000 off one course.
Wow, that must have been TPC down at the Sawgrass or something where you're pulling that many out of. Well, listen, so your balls are available. They're all used balls, but they're available online. I guess you're in Sears stores. You're available through Amazon. You're available through eBay. And also you can visit your website, www.absolutegolfball.com. Anything else that you'd like to talk about the business?
Yes, we have a handicap facility in Lapeer, Michigan that we contract. They sort all of our balls after we fish them out of the ponds. And they're a fantastic organization, Growth and Opportunity in Lapeer, Michigan.
So you're helping the economy here in Michigan. You're providing jobs for mentally challenged or handicapped individuals, and it's all U.S.-based.
Yes.
Fantastic. My hat's off to you. We will definitely look for that, and our listeners should go to www.absolutegolfball.com. Check out the website. Buy some balls and help out the economy a little bit.
Thank you. Have a great day.
Jim,
that was Jim Starr, the president of Absolute Golf Ball. And great story, Fred, definitely, especially I like that part. You know, they're helping not only the economy in the U.S., but they're helping handicapped people through that program that they have with in Lapeer with Growth and Opportunity. So definitely, like you said, my hats are also got to go off to them. Anytime that you see promoting jobs in the U.S., and especially to handicapped people, that's takes the top level for me.
Yeah, he's really an impressive young guy. Really enjoyed talking to him. And he's on the verge of really kind of exploding his business. He's getting involved in a large co-op type system and should even grow his business at a much more rapid rate. But, you know, I looked at his website. I've seen his balls. I mean, they clean them up. They're really good. I mean, they're like new golf balls. So, and the pricing is great. I mean, you can buy 5 dozen balls for like, you know, $20 or something. I think you can buy 3 or 4 dozen Pro V1s for, you know, like $20-$30 or something like that. So, you know, anybody that's looking for some, all of you golf hackers out there that need some golf balls, this is a place to get them.
Definitely, that will be my next place to start buying, because, you know, we're going to be talking about hard golf courses, and I can hardly spend that much money on golf, so we'll see. But anyway, our second VIG, very important guest of the week, his name is Steve Eubanks, and he's a New York Times best-selling author and award-winning writer. His work has appeared in Sports Illustrated, Golf Digest, Golf World, Golf Magazine, Golf for Women, TNL Golf, Lynx, Sports Unlimited, Garden and Run, Racing Fan, and USA Today, and on FoxSports.com, Yahoo, and PGAtour.com. I don't know if I missed any, but that's a long list.
I think that pretty much has been everywhere.
Yeah. He's also a former college golfer and PGA club pro. He's the author of more than 30 books and a senior writer for Global Golf Post. He currently lives in Peachtree City, in Georgia, with his wife and children. So, Fred, how about this interview with Steve Eubanks?
I have read Steve Eubanks' books and columns for years, and it was truly a pleasure to get to talk to him for this interview. His article in this week's Global Golf Post talks about a young amateur collegiate golfer who has already finished high up in a professional PGA Tour event, and he discusses what it takes to be the next biggest thing in golf. He agrees in the interview that golf courses have been built far too difficult for the average golfer and does not enjoy, like you or me, to even play in that much. So we think a lot alike, and he's a really great writer, and we had a nice chat.
So let's hear it.
We want to welcome best-selling author and senior writer for Global Golf Post to the Back Nine Report, Steve Eubanks. Steve, so happy to have you here to talk with us today.
It's great to be with you, as always.
Hey, Steve, you have had a fairly distinguished pedigree as a writer. You New York Times best-selling author, award-winning. Your work has appeared in Sports Illustrated, Golf Digest, Golf World, Golf Magazine, Golf for Women. You've pretty much been everywhere. How did you get started in golf? What is your background? What turned you on to golf to start with?
Well, I played in college, and quite frankly, I think like a lot of people, I got out and really couldn't do anything else. I was a club pro for a number of years, and throughout that process, I enjoyed writing and was, you know, making some contributions here and there. A good friend of mine was the first editor of Lynx magazine, and he asked me to come do some stuff for him, so I did. Caught the bug from there, and really that's where it took off.
Yeah, that's phenomenal. You've kind of strayed a little bit from golf, though. You wrote a really good book, All American. It was about the captains, the participants in the Army-Navy game, and then going over to Iraq and tell us a little bit about that.
Well, I tell you, I had always wanted to do a book about our modern heroes, this generation. I wasn't really sure what I could do, being a sports writer. But then I actually picked up Laura Hillenbrand's great book, Unbroken, and if anybody hasn't read that, I highly recommend it. And when I finished, I thought, you know what, that's how you do it. I knew the guys who had played in that 2001 Army-Navy game hadn't gone to the academies expecting to go to war. We were a peacetime nation at the time. Most of them had gone to play football. But all of that changed on 9/11, which occurred, of course, right at the beginning of that 2001 football season. So I knew if I could find two guys who played against each other in that 01 game and follow their careers for the next 10 years, that I might come up with some interesting stories. I really had no idea what I would get. And the men that I was able to follow and the stories that I was able to come up with are nothing short of extraordinary. I'm so honored to have been able to tell their stories. It's really been a special thing.
Yeah, really, really good piece there. Recommend it highly for anyone out there looking for a great book to read. You did a book about Augusta, Home of the Masters, another really good book. But also I see you did, and I have not looked at this one, so you're going to have to fill me in a little bit, Golf's Ultimate 18. And, you know, our hot topic tonight is going to take on some of the toughest golf courses in the U.S. and why golfers want to kill themselves losing golf balls and, you know, and their sunny dispositions while beating themselves up playing over these tough golf courses. What's your take on that, and what did you learn from studying some of the really good golf courses?
Well, obviously, what I wanted to do was take the best first hole in golf, the best second hole in golf, and it's very difficult to do that. When you get these compilations of best holes here and there, a lot of what makes these holes so good is it's where they're located, where, you know, the other holes that surround them, where they are geographically on the map, but also where they fall in the round. So, you know, for example, I wanted to take, I think one at Cherry Hills is a prime example. I mean, in its day, it was a drivable par four, a lot of history there. It's a gentle opening hole, but it was also a dramatic opening hole. So I wanted to go through all of the great golf courses in the world and come up with what I consider to be really the 18 best that fought the way they fell on the card. So the best first hole, the best second hole, the best third hole, all the way through. And you know, again, I throw that out there because anytime you have a subjective book like that, it sparks discussion. And that was what I had hoped to accomplish here, was for have people start saying, no, I like this second hole or I like this third hole. But to answer your question about the difficulty, look, I think that one of the problems that we've had in golf recently, it has become just too hard. And it's not to say that the game is ever going to be easy. It's not. I mean, it's just a hard game by its nature. But the idea that you have to go out there and torture yourself for 4 and 5 hours every day, look, I don't get it. I don't understand why people feel the need to do that. And I take Doral as a prime example, where the tour just was. That golf course was borderline unplayable at times. And I can understand why Rory McIlroy threw his 3-iron in the water. I mean, if it were that difficult, most of the guys I play with would have emptied their entire bags. I mean, it was just to the point of being almost silly. And when you reach that point, nobody's having fun. And the game has eventually got to be fun. And you know, what's wrong with having some birdies and having the best players in the game shoot 10, 12, 14 under? I think it's fine. I think most people think it's fine. And I think we've really gone over the edge in terms of making some of these golf courses too difficult.
Yeah, the people are like that, I think, like NASCAR racing, you know, watching it for the wreckage. And also, they probably enjoy watching U.S. Opens, struggle around in UD Hay and those kind of things. So I'm not a big fan of that myself. And I don't even like to play golf courses like that, not even once. Right? You know, why beat yourself up? And that's going to be kind of the point of our discussion here in a little bit. But, yeah, those are really good points. Hey, and what are you seeing? You know, we're seeing so many of the younger guys, you know, with Tiger, you know, out doing what he's doing. You know, Phil's not, you know, I think age maybe has finally caught up with him. Young guys are really the story on the West Coast. Dustin Johnson's come back. What's your take on the kind of the state of the PGA Tour right now?
Well, look, it's as exciting as I've seen it in a long time. And I hope that one of the problems is Tiger spoiled us. I mean, he was such a larger-than-life personality during his heyday. He brought so many eyeballs to golf that normally would never have watched golf. And he did some extraordinary things that we won't see for generations to come. that I hope that, that he hasn't set an unrealistic bar for everybody that comes after him. I mean, when you have players like Rory McIlroy and Dustin Johnson and J.D. Holmes, who's been playing incredibly well after his comeback, I mean, these are great things to watch and great people to watch and a lot of excitement and drama. In terms of the next big thing, who knows? I mean, this game is so fickle that the greatest amateur in the game right now may never get his tour card. All you can do is watch the skill level and watch the determination and look at the personalities of some of these players and make your best guess. I wrote a piece recently about John Rahm, who is currently at ASU. He played extremely well in the Waste Management Open. He's one of those guys. He's certainly got the skill level to do it. He's got all of the tools. He's got the disposition. He's got a wonderful personality. He's an athlete. I mean, when you look at him, he looks like he could be playing defensive end for somebody. So all of the things are in place. It's just a function of whether or not he's able to perform at the highest level. He did one week. If he's able to continue to do it, he could well be the next big thing. But as I tell everybody, take everybody who predicts these things, take it with a grain of salt, because nobody knows.
Yeah, Steve was just talking about his latest article in Global Golf Post. A really good read. I looked through it already this morning. And if our listeners have not clicked on and read the Monday's issue of Global Golf Post, I recommend they do that. So, well, Steve, thank you again so much for coming on and talk to us. Really appreciate your thoughts and comments, and hope that you will come back and talk to us again someday.
Well, Fred, it's been a real pleasure. Anytime.
Well, there you have it. That was Steve Eubanks. And Fred, wow, I mean, he can talk, and you know that he knows what he's saying. And I really love that part about people predicting things, you know, take it with a grain of salt. You know, we all like to do that, but at the end of the day, hey, we really don't know what's going to come.
Yeah, you know, the tour is in a state of change for sure. You know, with Tiger, who knows what's going to happen with him, and Phil, you know, he may have some good a month or something, but it's just not going to be a long-term thing for him anymore. So, yeah, but we got all these great young guys. We got a lot of good stuff going on, but these guys, you know, like Eubanks and Ron Green, and you know, they're around. They're out there on the tour, maybe not every week, but you know, probably 20 some weeks a year, and so they're with these guys. They know what's going on. It's always great to pick their brain and see what they're thinking.
Definitely. So that wraps up our very important guests of the week, James Starr and Steve Eubanks. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we have the practice range. Our topic of the week is none other than tackling the toughest courses in the U.S. and why would anybody play them. Don't go away. We'll tackle that when we come back at the practice range.
Thank you for listening to the Back Nine Report presented by eDraft.com. We'll be right back. Don't forget to check out our co-hosts on Twitter by clicking their names in the episode description. Now, back to the show.
And we're back. Now it's time for the practice range. Every week, Fred and I pick a topic of the week, which him and I take our own shots and try to take it to the practice there and see our own opinions about it. This week, we're going to talk about golf, U.S. golf's hardest courses, and why would pros or let anybody else like to play on them? I mean, let's be honest. I mean, I like challenges, but I am in no hurry to go on our expedition and climb Mount Everest. Or much simpler, a Junca here in Puerto Rico. It's just nonsense. I mean, I just can't spend as much money as I would need to buy enough balls to play any of them, which would be more expensive buying the balls than paying the fee to play them. I can't do that, so I would not even try it. So, you know, once Jack Nicklaus was once asked to rate a handful of classic courses on a scale of difficulty from 1 to 10, and he rated Augusta National, Oak Hill, St. Andrews, and Seminole all 8s, Valtuzro and Pebble Beach merited a 10. How about Wingfoot? 11, he responded. Well, maybe 12. So is Wingfoot West the toughest track of them all? According to a golf.com list of the top 10 toughest golf courses in the U.S., number one was Whistling Straits in Haven, Wisconsin. Number two was Oakmont in Oakmont, Pennsylvania. Number three was Pine Valley in Pine Valley, New Jersey. Number four, Kiawa Island Resort, the ocean course in Kiawa Island, South Carolina. Number five was TPC Sawgrass, the Player Stadium in Ponte Vedra Beach in Florida. Number six was Bethpage Black, the Black Course in Farmingdale, New York. Number seven was PGA West, TPC Stadium course there in La Quinta, in California. Number eight, Wingfoot West, okay, Mamma Ronick, New York. Number nine was Spyglass Hill in Pebble Beach, California. And number 10 was Wolf Creek in Mesquite, Nevada. You know, I'm sure that after Donald Trump saw this, he called out the president of the magazine immediately, complaining after that list was published that his dear baby Trump girl wasn't at the top of that list. I'm just sure about it. But we can argue that there was no love either for in that list for courses like PGA National and Augusta. You know, so Fred, I would like to know about, I don't know about you, but how about that list or anything about the toughest golf courses in the U.S.?
Well, there are a lot of courses that are not on the list, but just talking about that list for a minute, Whistling Straits, Pete Dye design. He does all the courses for Herb Kohler up there in Wisconsin. You know, it's been the site of a PGA Championship. It's going to host a Ryder Cup. Sits hard by Lake Michigan. The wind blows. It's just a beast. Beautiful place, but it is tough. We've seen what Oakmont can be like when the USGA sets it up for U.S. men's and women's opens. Just really, really difficult place. Yeah, Pine Valley. We don't get to see it because they don't let the pros, the tournaments come in there. Like Seminole, another course. It's not on the list, but, you know, those two courses you don't get to see, but they're just tough, tough golf courses. Kiawa Island, the ocean course, has hosted Ryder Cups and PGA Championships and always challenges the very best players in the game. Guess who designed it? Oh, yeah, Pete Dye. TPC Sawgrass. You know, it's feared among even the professionals that play the Players' Championship on the stadium course every year. Pete and Alice Dye, another one. Bethpage Black, it's a public golf course. But the sign at the first tee warning players that this course is for accomplished players only pretty much tells you everything you need to know, Carlos. Don't tee it up here if you're going to hack it around because you'll be out here all day. You might get lost in the straw. And it's an A.W. Tillinghast. And Tillinghast has a reputation for building very difficult golf courses, but very unique, very wonderful golf courses. PGA West, you mentioned that. It's another TPC course the desert. Very tight fairways, smallish greens, very, very deep bunkers. I've seen some real train wrecks there. You know, they've had the Qualify Q School there over the years and different tournaments. It can get to be a pretty tough place to play. Wingfoot, you talked about. Nicklaus talked about how tough it is. It's another Tillinghast design. Spyglass Hill out on the Monterey Peninsula, part of the Pinehurst Resort. It's a Robert Trent Jones. We haven't mentioned Robert Trent too much in this list, but he is renowned for building very difficult golf courses. Some of the places you didn't mention, Olympic Club in San Francisco, Crystal Downs, which is a McKenzie up here in Michigan, Cypress Point, which is another McKenzie course out there on the Monterey Peninsula, with those demanding carries over the Pacific and with the waves crashing in. You know, there's just some very difficult golf courses out there, Carlos, and I know people have them high on their list. But, you know, the pros play them. And I understand that they are competing. They're the very best, competing against the very best, and you want to identify who is the best of the best. I can see that. But for the average player, it might be a little bit too much at times.
It might be. And that's the thing, one of the things that you were mentioning when you were talking to Steve in the interview was that, you know, I don't like to see pros having such a hard time. I mean, Pete Dye, you mentioned him a lot of times there. His design golf courses are so difficult and so torturous that he has earned the nickname the Marquis de Sade. You know, it's incredible. And why would you like to play those? Maybe it's just a challenge, you know, just make sure I was the one that survived that course and I won it. Maybe that's what the pros are thinking. But really, I don't like, as much as I don't like to see defensive struggles in football, I don't like to see a 3-0 football game. I like to see them swinging and scoring and doing high scores, I mean low scores. And, you know, that's what I like about golf, when they do those great shots, but those difficult courses, and then you see them struggling in their body language and all that, and it doesn't make up, not even for good TV, let alone great golf. So I certainly don't like it. I'm sure you already said it that you don't like it either, but you know, that's the way it is. And so I don't know, what would you have to say about that, about watching pros, you know, struggling like kids or like me playing in any course, you know?
I'm not a fan. I am not a fan, and you know, Charlie Reimer made a really good point on Golf Channel on Morning Drive the other day. He said, you know, the PGA Tour is made up of many different styles of golf courses. You know, and over the course of the year, you know, short hitters and control players get their golf courses. You know, they get the Hilton Heads. You know, they get some shorter golf courses where control is more important than distance. And then you get courses like Doral or like Augusta where, you know, the bombers have the advantage because they're wide open. You can hit it way down there. So it is made up of a variety. And so that helps identify winners or different types of players. And a player like a Tiger Woods or a Jack Nicklaus that can win on a lot of different golf courses and play all those different styles, that's really to be admired because, you know, the old saying, you know, horses for courses. And there are certain guys that play certain courses well, and then you don't see them the rest of the year. So, you know, Pete Dye, as you mentioned, we talked about him a lot there in that list. And I've never been a big Pete Dye fan, but I was down at PGA Village a year ago last winter, and there's a beautiful Pete Dye golf course there at PGA Village. I had a chance to... on the West Virginia trip I took last year to play a Pete Dye course, and I loved it. It was a difficult golf course, but there were areas that even an average golfer like me could hit the ball to. I didn't have to be a pro to really enjoy playing the golf course. It was beautiful. It was a great layout. I really liked it. The next day, and I don't like to throw anybody under the bus, but we played an Arnold Palmer golf course, and it was really too difficult. I did not enjoy playing it. There was a lot of force carries for a resort course. I felt it was really difficult to play. So, you know, the bottom line here is that, oh, well, I should mention too, and on that same trip I got to play the Greenbrier, and I got to play the Old White TPC, which hosts the Greenbrier Classic, and also the Greenbrier course, which is hosted a Ryder Cup and a President's Cup. And I highly enjoyed playing both of those golf courses because from the white tees, you could play them. You know, the pros have to go back to the tips. But, you know, for the that, and to me, a designer's biggest task is to design a golf course that tests the pro or the scratch player from the back, but also the average golfer, you know, the 12 to 18 or 20 handicap golfer can really enjoy playing too. That to me is the designer's biggest task, biggest challenge.
How about your bucket list? Which would be, I mean, I live in the Caribbean, Puerto Rico. I have seen many golf courses here, and I could say, you know, about Pete Dye, the one very near to me in Dominican Republic, the Teeth of the Dog in Casa de Campo. I mean, that's a huge, almost 7,500 yards long, par 72, and which has, you know, Pete Dye describes and claims that the design was simple for him because God made seven holes, and all of which are skirting the ocean, more than Pebble Beach, and he only had to come up with another 11. But, man, those 11, oh, my, why did he do them? Why? That's so tough. I mean, it's beautiful, but tough, you know. And also, talking about Robin Trent Jones, Jr., he in Royal Westmoreland in Barbados, another beautiful golf course, but, man, tough, especially at sixth. They have a par 3, 357 yards. Why? That's a par 4, easily, you know. So, and it's a dogleg also, so tough, tough, tough. But anyway, which would be the toughest ones that you would have played, and which ones, if any, would you like to play?
Well, I'm going to comment on a few, Carlos. You know, I was out to Chambers Bay last fall. It's going to be the site of the U.S. Open this summer. And, you know, it's really a difficult golf course. But I would like to play that golf course. The difficulty is around the greens on that golf course, not in the tee or the fairway. There are some generous hitting areas there, so you can play it. But it's challenging up around the greens, big bunkering. A lot of slope, the putting. You're going to see a lot of three putt and four putts on that golf course. Of course, Augusta National, you know, provides a test not only off the tee but around the greens. Those green complexes, you know, the slopes, some of the different angles you have to have there. In that golf course, the key is there. Hitting irons in from the fairways to make sure you're in a place where you have a putt, because if you get above the hole there, you have no chance. TPC Sawgrass, we're going to see it at the Players here in a couple weeks. I do like watching the pros dunk balls in the water at 17, but really other than that, that course reminds me of a tricked-up putt-putt golf course, kind of only lacking a windmill and a clown's mouth. Trump Doral. I think I would like the other courses at Doral a lot more than I would like the Blue Monster. There's just too much water there for me. You know, we saw PGA Nationals Bear Trap 15, 16, and 17. Those play difficult for the pros. I can't imagine what they would be like for me. So I guess the bottom line here is that, you know, Augusta National, I would love to be able to say I played it one time. But I have been at the Masters a few times, walked the course. That's really plenty for me. It's hallowed ground, and the respect that the membership of Augusta National give to that old course and how they take care of it, that's very rewarding to me. But I guess highest on my bucket list right now, I would say, is Pebble Beach and Bandon Dunes, of places I haven't played, of difficult golf courses that I'd like to play, and I hope to get to those in the very near future.
Well, to me, if I would like to be a masochist and try to go to any of those courses, I would say the Ocean Course in Kiawah Island, South Carolina. I would like to play that one. And maybe, you know, that exercise in masochism called Whistling Straits there in Kohler. So those would be the two that I would like to play sometime if I have the money to do it and the patience to go there. Well, we have a minute and a half to go, so any final words you would like to go and say before we close?
Yes. Okay. Arnie will not miss being the honorary starter. Neither flood, famine, or a bum shoulder will keep Arnie away from his duties as one of the honorary starters for the Masters in April. Age 85, he fell, hurt his shoulder, been laid up, but he's going to be there on the first tee. Davis Love, Jay Haas picked Davis Love for one of his assistant captains, so for the President's Cup. So now Davis is the president of the Tournament Players Committee. He's the Ryder Cup captain, and now he's going to be an assistant for Jay Haas. He's a busy guy. USGA has announced their site for the sectionals. You can go to the USGA.org to see those. So, Carlos, I think that's about all that I have for tonight.
Well, Back Niners, that wraps up another week of the Back Nine Report presented by eDraft.com. It's always our pleasure to bring you the latest on the world of golf. Thank you for listening to us for the past hour. Special thanks to our VIGs this week. Our very important guest of the week were Jim Starr, president of Absolute Golf Ball, and the best-selling author and award-winning writer, Steve Eubanks. Don't forget to join us again next Tuesday at 8 p.m. Eastern Time here on Block Talk Radio. And also, tune in or download our show on iTunes. If you haven't done so, follow the show on Twitter. Our ID is at Back9Report. My name is Carlos Torres. Along with Fred Alvader, we wish you to be happy, be blessed, and enjoy the great game of golf. Happy golfing, everybody.
Good night, everybody.